I really am enjoying very much the conference, so it's great to be able to be here. In the last few years, together with Leonardo and other people, we've been thinking quite a bit about non-Gaussianism for inflation, and I want to summarize a little bit motivations why we've been doing this, or at least my motivations why I've been doing this, and some of the results that we have gotten. So basically, today in cosmology we have a very nice standard model, a universe filled with radiation, dark matter, a little bit of a cosmological constant, Gaussian initial conditions that are scale invariant put there at the very beginning. This fits pretty much everything very nicely. And I think we are at the stage of seeing if we can find any sort of departure from this minimalistic story to see if we can learn something extra from about some of these things, like cosmological constant or dark matter or the initial conditions. And today I'm going to talk about mainly the initial conditions, so that for all we know at the moment they're just consistent with just being scalar, fluctuations, scale invariant, so no gravitational waves, scale invariant, adiabatic, Gaussian. That fits the data pretty well. So, for example, this game, of course, now is always about fitting precise parameters. We know many things very, very well. So this is from WMAP, a bunch of parameters. But if you open that paper, you can see exactly this thing about testing for seeing if we see some hint of anything extra. So their table goes through one by one, putting one of these potential things that might be there, gravitational waves, or the running of the spectral index, or curvature, or non-adiabatic fluctuations, seeing if there's any evidence in the data for any departures from the minimal model. And basically, the answer is usually no. There's just no evidence, except maybe it depends on how you count. But there is some evidence that the fluctuations are not perfectly scale invariant, that the spectral index deviates from one by something like this. So if you want, that might be the only departure from the minimal model, although if you believe in inflation, that's what you expected, so it's not even a departure from the minimal model, it's just what it was supposed to be to start with. So in terms of things like another way of looking at this, the typical plot of the amplitude of gravitational waves versus the tilt of the spectrum, and you can see that no gravitational waves and a scale invariant spectrum, it's a little bit off. So it's not the perfect fit, so there might be some evidence of something, but for the most part, the minimalistic thing works really well, and if by minimalistic you also allow for a tilt in the spectrum, then it works perfectly. Nothing extra. So in the talk, then I want to mainly talk about the understanding the part of this model that has to do with the initial conditions, and we have a standard paradigm for the origin of these initial conditions, which is that these initial conditions have a quantum mechanical origin. That's our basic idea. And not ours, me, but the basic idea around, and it's been around for quite a while. So I was pointed to some lecture by Dirac, pretty old, right, from the beginning of quantum mechanics. And if you read, I don't have time to read, but we can chat later. But mainly he says, well, probably initial conditions are for the universe are quantum mechanical origin, and these days. We have a way to implement this idea, a standard way to implement this idea, which is through inflation. So we think that if the universe went through a period of inflation in the past, then we can get the initial conditions that are consistent with our observations by having this period of inflation in the past. Now, of course, this is not at all at the same level. The fact that we think that inflation might have happened is not at all at the same level of confidence with which we know the rest of things in cosmology. In fact, we cannot even tell anybody the parameters of this inflationary theory very much. I mean, we cannot even tell at what energy scale it happened. It can, you know, be many orders of magnitude, how many fields, all of these things are up in the air. So our confidence that this indeed happened cannot be very high. We cannot really pinpoint anything other than the amplitude of fluctuation is something like as such. So we shouldn't, I don't think we should go around saying inflation happened. But it's our best, it's our, you know, not our best, perhaps, I shouldn't say our best year. It's one, it's, you know, one of the nicest contenders. But so it would be great if one day, you know, inflation gets to be at the same level as we believe in Big Bang nucleosynthesis, for example. We're not at there at this point. Although Big Bang nucleosynthesis maybe doesn't work as well as but in order to get there, we definitely will need some additional hints from the data. And we don't know if we're going to get these hints or not, but, you know, it'd be good if we get...
I don't know.
if we get additional hints. So let's start by talking about the most constrained setup of inflation. So I want to discuss non-Gaussianism then in the context of inflation and as a possible additional hint of what might have happened. So the minimal situation for talking about inflation is talking about a period of accelerated expansion with h dot much more than h squared, and where single field, basically, quantum fluctuations of the clock that tells the universe locally when to stop inflation are the sources of density perturbations. And so let me start by trying to motivate why thinking about non-Gaussianity by talking about, you know, the different probes that we might have of these. And we all know about them. So we might be able to measure, you know, in detail the spectrum of density perturbations, and using that we might constrain the field better. We might be able to see a background of gravitational waves. And the last then of this possible hints is a detection of whether or not, there could be that the fluctuations are not adiabatic, for example, and another hint might be that the fluctuations are not Gaussian. Now, saying that the fluctuations are Gaussian, or saying that something is not Gaussian, appears, you know, it's not so well defined. What does it mean that it's not Gaussian? Can it be not Gaussian in any way? What should we be looking for in the data? So, you know, you might argue you should look for everything, or you might argue that you should first think about what to look for, at least if you're trying to understand things in the context of some theoretical background that you have, like inflation, and then just go look for that. And I would argue that that's a better approach, in that if you look just for any type of weird thing in the data, departure from the... you have to be able to... You would end up paying some sort of trials factor as to how many weird things you look for. Is not well defined, because you look at the data and something pops out, and then you start trying to invent a statistic that makes this be shows how weird it is, but you already looked at it before. So it's not so easy. For example, the fact that the map was had been signed by Stephen that is visiting here. Should we take this seriously? Is this what we expected? Should we try to calculate the probability of this to happen or not? I mean, this is the real thing. This guy, it's not a joke. So anyway, so it would be better if we can, or I would argue it would be better to just look for things that first, at least, to start to look for things that we might have expected, although maybe we should have expected. So let's see. So that's one motivation. But let's try to think about another motivation, which would be: imagine that we got one of these hints, one of these different hints that we might have. You know, what might they teach us? So, and what I would try to argue is that if we were lucky enough that there are departures from Gaussianity, because they can have a quite a rich structure, and so we might learn more than if we just measure the tilt of the two-point function, for example, which I guess it's pretty obvious in that the departure from Gaussianity is not just characterized by one number. But let me just go a little bit through that argument. So our universe is pretty, you know, so it looks, our theorem predicts a universe which is translation invariant, and it's pretty much scale invariant. So by the time you say translation invariant and scale invariant, then you're done with the two-point function. It's a power law with a fixed index. So translation scale invariance in inflation comes from the fact that of time translation invariance during inflation. So from the fact that h dot is much smaller than h squared, for example, the slow road parameters, that is what basically makes the two-point function scale invariant. We know that inflation has to end, so it cannot be that nothing is changing, so things will be changing, so the expression will not be perfectly scale invariant. But now how not scale invariant the spectrum is going to be is not something we really can predict. Now, of course, if somebody tells you the model of inflation is this, you definitely can calculate this, but nobody can. On the basis of just, there's just an inflationary model that will accommodate pretty much any value of the tilt that we could measure in the near future. So even if this error bar were going down, it's not going to fundamentally change our belief or not belief in inflation at the moment, because we could accommodate any value. So it's great that it comes out in the range that we might expect, but there's not that much information there, unfortunately. It's not a make or break for inflation, I would say. Other thing at the background of gravitational waves, of course, this would be great to measure the background of gravitational waves, maybe because we think that the amplitude of the tensor mode is just given by the Hubble constant during inflation in Planck units. So at least we would, this would just make one of the parameters totally. And so, it'd be great to at least have one number. I think we should revisit this. Those are the more standard hints that we're looking for. What about deviation from Gaussianity? So now, if you want to talk about the three-point function, for example, the three-point function correlates three k modes, but because of translation invariance, they have to add up to zero. Scale invariance basically tells you that the three-point function that is a function of these three k's can only really be a function of the ratios of them. But even after you impose scale invariance and translation invariance, you're left with a free function of two variables, of two continuous variables, that is a possible three-point function allowed by those symmetries, translation invariance and scale invariance. Right? So in principle, we could say, anything could go, and we should look for any possible three-point function. And so if it were the case that I would try to argue that there are certain rules and not everything goes in the context of inflation, then it looks like there's quite a bit of information, because there is the chance of making a measurement and finding something that we can actually just not predict from inflation, or distinguishing between certain mechanisms. So it's much more than just a number. It's a full function of two variables. And it gets better and better as you consider higher moments. So if there were a four-point function that you could detect, even after scale invariance and translation invariance, it's still a function of five variables. So it could be a pretty complicated function. So if there are some rules that we could convince ourselves that certain things are possible, certain things are not possible, it'd be great if we were to detect these things. So I guess the motivation for, the summary, I would say the motivation for looking at non-Gaussianities, it shares with the other possible hints about the early universe that it might give us information, and we don't necessarily know whether this will end up happening, whether there will be a background of gravitational waves that we can detect or not, whether non-Gaussianities would be large enough that we can detect or not. But at least there's potentially a lot of information. So I think it's also not a trivial thing to figure out necessarily what you might expect or not expect, what exactly to look for. And if you don't want to pay a big trials factor for trying everything, it'd be great to, if there's a small number of options, to figure them out in advance. So that's the motivation. So the way I think to think about, in order to try to answer this question, the best way to think about it is using this effective theory of inflation developed by Leonardo and his collaborators. This is a very nice way, in my opinion, to condense all of the inflationary models and really take out what is common to all of them. And it turns out that there's a lot of things that you can say about these non-Gaussianities, about various things, that really it might look that you can write whatever potential you want, you can do whatever you want, and so how can you get any prediction for this thing at all? But that's not true. There are specific rules. And so how this thing works is the following. So I think the easiest way to think about it is, if we are talking about in the context of single field inflation, single clock inflation, in which then the fluctuations that we see today are the fluctuations due to quantum fluctuations in the clock that tells the universe when to finish in place. And then we can always use as coordinates whatever locally whatever this clock is measuring, and so the clock itself disappears. And if you go to that gauge, the unitary gauge, then you should be able to write the Lagrangian for fluctuations in a way that just depends on the metric fluctuations. And this is the most general Lagrangian for every inflationary model that boils down, or for this kind of single thing, boils down to this, basically, with a few caveats that I can go into if you want. But in this way of doing it, you've already used the ability to change the time variable to eat the metric, the phi fluctuation. So this action need not be fully diff invariant. It can have things like G00. It can have things related to the curvatures of the surfaces of constant time. So in addition to the Einstein action, there are things that break time diff invariance. But these are what they are. This is just the most general thing the most general Lagrangian for fluctuations. In an expansion in the fluctuations of G00 plus 1 is a small thing, G00 on Q, blah, 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 and in derivatives. These are things that involve derivatives. So this is, you can write every model of inflation in this way. It's an expansion in the size of the fluctuations, which we know they're small, and in derivatives, which if we are caring about what happens at the Hubble scale during inflation, they are also small.
So Matthias, yeah. G0 space is 0.
G0
space.
IJ. It is there, but it cannot appear by its this theory still has to have you have the ability to change your spatial coordinates as you want.
That is to say G01.
Yeah, G01.
Is 0?
No.
They're free. And where do they appear?
Inside of R instead of the square root of G. R is
R is a normal.
So this, if you want, this is a no. If you had a theory like d phi squared, for example, this is g mu nu, d mu phi. This is going to the gauge in which phi is unperturbed, so this only has phi dot, and so you get g upper 0 0 times phi dot square. Yeah. This is this.
So you're basically using the inflaton as time.
Yeah, the inflaton is time. So the whole point about this is that because you're a single field and you can use the inflaton, I mean, and by definition you can use the inflaton by time, it's easy to characterize what can be the Lagrangian of fluctuations in terms of an expansion in, I mean, so for example, all single field inflationary models, usual ones with normal kinetic term and V of phi, they just live in the first line. I mean, that's it. And so all of the predictions just went down to saying who is H dot, what's the history. We already know because they only depend on the slow rate parameters. But the action for the fluctuation is just this period. So you need to just specify H dot, H, and that's the end of the story. Now, if you have a higher kinetic term, then you start getting these things. But this is the most. So, in other words, you should ask Leonardo, who's the one who invented this. I think the logic for this is we are going to measure the fluctuations, or we are measuring the fluctuations. Let's just not write the Lagrangian for phi. We just write the Lagrangian for what we measure, the Lagrangian for the fluctuation. This Lagrangian, you can convince yourself that it depends on a bunch of free parameters, and let's just constrain those free parameters, period.
In some ways, there's a background, there's a classical background. Right?
Yeah, the classical background, but we don't even need to talk about the classical background. Because, of course, if I have a scalar field, I background, I expand, I go to the gauge, I get this. But this could be valid. I don't know how the background comes about. As long as this is the most general theory of fluctuation, scalar fluctuation, at about a given background. I give you the background, H dot, this is the story.
Okay?
So rather than telling you what's the potential, tell me the background.
H is given as a function of
time. Yeah, H is given as a function of time, H dot is given as a function of time. This is the Lagrangian for the fluctuations, period. And in fact, because we only measure a small number of equalities, we can tailor expand H around this, and then it depends on a few parameters. So all of the theories of inflation just depend on these few parameters. Let's just constrain those few parameters, and that's the end of the story. I don't know. The good thing about this is that it allows you to figure out some of these relations of what the you know, the three-point function can be or cannot be in a way that you can convince yourself is pretty general. So that's it.
But only for single-field inflation.
If I have time, which I don't have, I will tell you about what we have been doing so far for multi-field inflation. Of course, this, yes, only thing. We can try to extend, we have. And I have it towards the end, but probably won't. So you know, let's see. Another technique, if you really want to do predictions for the, in this case, it even gets easier than looking at this action, because you can reintroduce the fluctuations in the clock by making a time diffeomorphism and whatever, you know, in the metric above, and promoting that to a field, and then you just need to. You can convince yourself that you this is the standard Stueckelberg trick, and you can convince yourself that if you want to understand the fluctuations at energies of order Hubble during inflation, you just need to focus on this scalar degree of freedom, which then it boils down to whatever it was G00 in the metric before. You replace this by this, which is just whatever these phase transformations. So and this scalar part, the mixing of this with the rest of the metric is you don't need to worry about it. And so this entire most general Lagrangian for perturbations, in the end, it boils down to, for example, if you just keep the first, I mean, you can keep them all, but just for the purpose of this talk, the first example, if you just boils down to understanding this Lagrangian for the field pi, which is related to zeta, then by just zeta is h pi at the end. So you can calculate the fluctuation by looking at this Lagrangian, doing the standard thing of the way you calculate perturbations in inflationary models for this pi, and then zeta, the gain-invariant variable, is just h pi. And this Lagrangian just depends on a few parameters. That's the beauty of the whole story, and all of the examples, you know, are decided on this. Sorry.
No, it is
inside of this. All are inside of this. In what follows, I will restrict the time dependence to this to be slow for what I will talk now, but you can keep it.
What if you have negative spatial curvature? Does that fit in this framework? Say at the level of 10 to the minus 2, which is consistent with observation.
You give me a background, I will tell you the factor.
You didn't use the fact that the background is flatter?
Okay.
I think you did.
Flatter, what do you mean?
Spatially flat.
There is also, if you want, you can read the depth.
Yes. I mean, are you asking me in this general framework or in the things that I copied on the board? I will make a few restrictions when I quote it, which are morally fine, but there are some exceptions. But if I have to go through all the cases, but I think it's true that every model of inflation, including things in which you go to a washboard, and so you can fit it into this framework. In that case, this m of t, these are really functions of time, and so you just would need to keep that.
So the lower part, you could use that, strictly speaking.
So this lower part, now let me just, I mean, even, yeah, so the lower part, that's what I will restrict myself in the talk, just to give you concrete examples of how this works. So for example, I will restrict in the talk, I will not talk about higher derivative third things like cost inflation, but they are in there. I will just not concentrate for this talk. I will take these things to be suppressed, their time evolution to be also suppressed by slow roll parameters, just like H and H dot are suppressed by slow roll parameters. I will take that example, but I could also not do it for the purpose of this talk. So for example, things that follow from these, just to give you a flavor of the things that follow from this way of thinking about it. So notice that, again, this term and this term, they are all the coefficients
H, and those are fixed by the fact that by requiring that the background is actually a solution and that this action starts quadratic. So there's a bunch of coefficients that are fixed that I don't have, I cannot play with, but there are some few coefficients that are not free. So for example, so if you just look at the terms that can start quadratic, so something that affects just the two-point function only. You see this term is the standard one, but if you added this g00 plus 1 squared term, it can start quadratic. This term then would modify the speed of sound of the speed of propagation of fluctuations. But because remember that whenever, let's see, the rule is that if you know this pi, I should be able to make a coordinate transformation and we should all go away and be eaten by be just G00. So this means that there's a very specific structure of how the pi should appear here. So if I want to have a pi dot square from this term to modify the speed of sound, I will get interactions between the pi that I force on me just by So for example, if you want to change the speed of sound, you are forced to have interactions, cubic and quadratic interactions. So if you change the speed of sound, you have cubic interaction, you have a non-Gaussian, a three-point function. So that's one of the things that follow. If you the sound
is 0, W, K, A, T, B, 1, U, 0, O.
Okay, so
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why do you have gradients of G00? A special gradient of G00?
This action that you have it still has to respect that you have to be able to do
yes.
coordinate transformations.
Yeah.
Spatial, time dependent spatial diffeomorphism. If you put you won't do it. You can add more grad in a covariant way, and these are higher derivative terms that are here. And
no, but the gradient of G00 is not included in those terms.
Gradient of G00, spatial gradient,
yeah.
It would not be invariant.
Yes.
Yeah. So
it's not invariant on there?
I don't know.
I think it is.
Well, if you have an I,
it's fixing
general. We can discuss it. But I mean, this is just the most general action that is still invariant under time-dependent spatial diffeomorphism. So if you write some, all of the, that's how it was constructed. Every term with a metric that is invariant and that is in this list.
But R has functional dependence.
Sorry?
R has functional dependence. Back.
R?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that includes.
But R, you would not get a pi from here because.
No, but you do get a Laplacian of the G00 and the gradients of it.
Yeah, but so this is the full thing. If you want the equations for pi, but do you want, we can derive it.
Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. They're varied because R is complicated.
But you want things that are invariant under a special diffeomorphisms, right?
Yeah.
And gradient of G00 squared is invariant under a special.
Well, So, connection between sound speed and cubic term is one example. Another thing that you can get is that there are two types of cubic interactions, which are this pi dot cube here, and there's also a pi dot grad pi squared coming from. Pi dot grad pi squared that's there, there's a pi cube here and a pi cube there. So there's two types of three-point function that you can get in this way. So for example, something that you cannot get is a three-point function, this is, was known before this, but a three-point function that is non-zero in the squeeze limit, which means one of the k is much smaller than the other two. So this you cannot get from single field. And there are other things of this nature that you can do. So basically, if you want, informed by this, at least in the class of examples that I discussed today, there's basically three different type of shapes that you might imagine looking for. Well, from inflation, I said there were really two generated, if you want, these two operators. And this other one, this local one, is something that you, the one that is non-zero in the squeeze limit is usually called the local model. And that one is, you might want, so it's something that you might get in multi-field inflation, and it's something that is very simple both to look for and to get in some other context. It would be just something in which the curvature fluctuations are Gaussian plus the square of a Gaussian. So, but those three shapes are in some sense orthogonal, and you can look for the three of them separately, and if you look for, you know, the constraints, they're kind of orthogonal. So, okay, so that's just a little flavor of what you might get if you think about, if you try to characterize all the possible non-Gaussianities, at least in the three-point function, that you might get from the most general inflation models. And let me just leave it up. So what is the observational status? So let me go past the observational status. And of course, there's just upper limits on this, on departures from Gaussianity at the moment. So the first thing people look for was the simple local non-Gaussianity, in which it's a Gaussian plus the square of a Gaussian, which cannot be produced by single field inflation. So for example, that's a clear example of how looking for this might be very good, because if you were to detect this, and during some time there was even a two and something sigma claim that this was different from zero, you would rule out every single field inflation model. That's kind of a theory. So there's really a lot of information in that in the non-Gaussianities. Then after a while, it was realized through examples that there are possible large non-Gaussianities. These other types that's generated by this operator that could be produced by single field inflation. And these days we have limits on all of that. So, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Then also these parameters, FNL, they are a little bit historical in their the numbers look different, but they really mean the same. I mean, the level of non-Gaussianity of a given FNL of these different shapes is always the same, even though they look like the constraints are different from the same. Anyway, so we have constraints on those things, and you know, another way to think about it, as I was trying to tell you, this is the Lagrangian for fluctuation, at least dropping a few terms. In the paper, we do like all of the examples pretty much. But, you know, this is the most general Lagrangian for fluctuations around this background. It depends on these two parameters, and you can use the non-Gaussianities to constrain two parameters. It's just it's really at the level of like you would do testing of the electroweak theory or something like that. I think it's a very powerful way to think about it. So what about the four-point function? So I said, the four-point function might be even better because it's a function of five things. So maybe it has even more information. One naively would think, one would think that if there was a big four-point function on the data, probably there is a much bigger three-point function that one should detect first. That would be the first thing. And this, for example, yeah. So this is the first thing that you would think about. And I think this is for the most part true, but not 100% true. So you can imagine that there is a four-point function that is big. Even we haven't even looked for it in the data, so it could be there in the map, waiting for it to be discovered. And it could be large, but still not inconsistent with the fact that we did not have a three-point function. So what do I mean by that? So of course one can. Let's look at this, which is the most general, as I said, dimension for fluctuations. As I told you, each place where there's a G00, it's a non-linear function of this pi. So this thing, for example, has quadratic, cubic terms, quartic terms, and so on. So you might think, oh, if I have this term that is producing a three-point function, it would also produce a four-point function. But from those type of terms, it's for those terms, the intuition is totally correct, and it's if this term is there, it would produce a much larger three-point function than a four-point function. So neither this term nor this term, which produce three-point function, four-point function, five-point function, and so on, it would not be sensible to go look for the non-Gaussianities that they produce in the four-point function, because they would have a much bigger three-point function than we should have already seen. Okay. However, you can think. You can think of, what about starting with this term, G00 plus 1 to the fourth? that term already starts quartic in the fluctuation, so it just produces a four-point function and doesn't produce a three-point function. And so if that had a large coefficient, if that term had a large coefficient, then you would create a four-point function without necessarily having a three-point function. But clearly, you need to worry because if I have, because of this fact, if there is a four-point, if there is a quartic interaction, there's also a quintic interaction, and I can, you know, take the quintic interaction associated inside of this, close the loop, and this will generate effectively a three-point vertex. So I have to worry that if I say, ah, let's go look for a big four-point function, just closing the loop here will not generate a three-point function that is should have already been seen. And the bottom line is that when you do this loop calculation, that does not happen. And because I'm running out of time, I will not exactly explain why, but let me, I'm happy to say offline. But the other important thing is that it's just the four-point function from this particular, the quartic interaction from this particular interaction that has this property. And so the bottom line is that in single field inflation models, you might imagine that there is a non-zero four-point function, but of all the possible shapes, if you're going to have something which is does not have an associated much bigger four-point function, it can only be generated by this interaction. So there's one specific shape that if it's there, you might tolerate. Any other shape, it's inconsistent. Okay? Yeah?
So for example, the trispectrum correction that comes from graviton exchange could be parameterized by
Those are very, very small, so no, we're not. So in order to make them observable, you need to make, these interactions are much stronger than gravitational, the ones that we could have observed. So,
okay, so that's another term.
I mean, that's another term, but this is unobservable. So what I'm trying to say is that you can have sufficiently large coefficients for that interaction that to make it observable, but still not screwed up by that. Okay, so... and in terms of the observational status of the four-point function, I would say that in the CMB we have not looked for this pretty much, I think there's a lot of motivation to also put constraints on those because again, in the context of single field inflation, it's just a Lagrangian with a few parameters, and we can constrain them separately each. And there's a motivation for having a large four-point function without necessarily having. Does not contradict anything. I will basically skip this part, but the other thing that we have been thinking with Leonardo is how to extend these ideas to cases in which there's more than one field. Okay, can one build an effective theory along these lines that encompasses all these situations, encompasses many situations? I think maybe all is too much, but encompasses many situations, but still it has a few enough parameters so that one really doesn't need to talk about the potential, I mean, and all. And I think the answer is that we can do it, and we are trying to put out this paper, and we've been trying for a long time. So, but I don't know, it's done, but it's probably each time we have to read it because I don't know how many pages, like 80 pages, that takes a month. So, so but we at least in the next, in this iteration, what we have done is consider the case in which there are additional light scalar fields as well, and try to develop how those lights have to couple with pi, and then how to parameterize the way they affect the density fluctuations at the end. And I think we have some reasonable, consistent story that does not add too much complexity to the story. Or, I don't know, it's 80 pages, it must be adding something. You know, but so the bottom line, you want, I mean, let me just not go here. So the bottom line is that we think that there are additional motivations also for looking for a four-point function, and we have, for example, a few additional shapes on top of the pi dot to the four that we can, you know, create in a way that loops do not make the, you know, consistent with not being fine-tuned, basically, of different possible shapes for the four-point function, which could be there without having a much larger three-point function, for example. I think that is the most interesting of those conclusions, but they are specific shapes. So even though the four-point function is a function of five variables, there's just four or five things that one can actually think of producing. So to finish, let me say then that I think, of course, there's no guarantee by any means that that we will observe a large non-Gaussianity in upcoming experiments. I think, I mean, of primordial origin, this is a guarantee that the mass will not be Gaussian, perfectly Gaussian. But whether this this will be of primordial origin, we have no guarantee. But I think it's a very nice set of possible hints on the origin of perturbations, because it has a lot of structure in it, and so I think it's worthwhile to think about it, to put the best constraints of the data that we can possibly do, and hopefully they will be there. I mean, so let me finish.
In quantum field theory, the short distance expansion typically gives you some boost between pair of the three-point function, four-point function. Now, this doesn't put any constraints, for example, in the intelligent material?
I mean, there are rules, of course, so we are talking here about a very weakly coupled situation in which, if you have a quartic interaction, you will get a four-point function. If a cubic interaction, you will have a three-point function. And, you know, the only thing that you have to worry about is if loop corrections will not, if you want to say that, you know, there's a big four-point function and a three-point function, that this is kind of not fine-tuning as well. But I don't know, quartic, you're very close to the vacuum, and then a very small perturbation of quartic interaction will give you a four-point function. Cubic interaction will give you a three-point function.
The evolution of after inflation due to the nonlinearities will generate you FNL support per unit in something of many different types. Is there a chance that you can, if slow roll inflation will generate an FNL of order epsilon, so much smaller than one, is there a chance that one can still see these non-Gaussianities, these primordial ones, smaller than one?
Well, let's see. So. There are many aspects. So one is, for example, I didn't mention this, but I mainly focused on examples with large non-Gaussianities. But we know that even if you turn off all of these m coefficients and you're just left with the minimum thing, h dot, m plus, whatever, there's a minimum amount of non-Gaussianity, which is what you said, the FNL going like epsilon and eta and so on, which is what Pond calculated. Those are too small for the CMB to detect. If you had more, but not by so much, I suppose, but by like an order of magnitude or so, or maybe two. So you need measures with many more modes in order to bring the statistic enough to.
But the problem is that you have other.
Yeah. So in order to do that, you will probably have to come to surveys or in volume or locally and go to small scales to have enough modes, and it will bring all of these issues of. Non-Gaussianities that are not of primordial origin. Will we be able? So, in terms of counting modes, I think you can imagine a 21 centimeter survey this big. There's enough modes to do it. Now, can you tell it apart from other things? We are a long way from knowing if that's possible. They're different. I mean, the things produced by gravitational instability are not scaling variant because they have to do with the nonlinear scale. So they are different. Now, are they different enough?
I guess the expansion parameter, which makes the group small, that's h of n Planck or something?
The expansion parameters that make the loop small. So these theories, they're non-linearizable. They have to have a cutoff. And so in some sense, what makes the whole thing controllable is that you're interested in energies Hubble that should be much smaller than the cutoff. So that's.
So it's h of m Planck or something like that.
Lambda. Not m Planck would not be. In order to have large non Gaussianities, the cutoff cannot be m Planck.
Okay, so.
So the interactions have to be large because. So these high derivative operators that are doing the interaction, the cutoff for them is m Planck, they produce very significant non Gaussianities. So these are theories which have large interactions and have a in order for you to see the non-Gaussianity, so I have to make the interactions larger, so there'll be a cutoff for these things below.
Well, but typically, what is the expansion parameter?
Yeah, so H over lambda, so the cutoff, the cutoff. Which
well, what, is the, what do you choose for the cutoff?
Well, what you choose for the cutoff, we have the unitarity cutoff given by those operators. We know when the thing breaks, so that's what you're choosing.
Is there a coupling constant in the scalar field of Lagrangian? What is it there?
There are examples where it's the scalar field itself, where you get an expansion in derivatives of pi squared over pi to the fourth, say. And then
in this approach, it's like the cutoff for the pi and Lagrangian for the pi. Yes. Until you don't know what is QCD, the risk QCD, you don't know what is the cutoff. It's a free parameter. It's f pi. I mean, it's a free choice.
Well, okay, but what do you play when you calculate
the unitarity cutoff just to make sure?
You cannot calculate for the f pi from the pi and Lagrangian.
But these are three-level calculations. So
The question when I said that loops do not do not.
I see. Okay.
Any final question?
So it's reasonable if one has single fields. So you're following a trajectory, the fluctuations are along the trajectory. What I don't quite get is how you can be so optimistic about treating the incredible number of degrees of freedom you can have in the isocurvature direction with all of the possibilities that one can imagine.
Yes, I think all of these possibilities. Okay. Yeah.
So you have to be expanding in some sort of I don't like your theory because it's Baroque factor.
No. No. The trick is that all of that complexity that you're talking about happens when modes are outside the horizon. Okay. So there is a local relation in real space between the value of these isocurvature fields and the curvature perturbation that they produce at the end. This is a real relation in, that's why they produce, for example, local non-Gaussian. So in all of these examples, the effect of the, for example, let me take half of the examples. These isocurvature fields convert into the density fluctuations that we observe at reheating. Okay, that's one example. But this happens the most of the outside the horizon.
I realize all those models. I'm thinking more of as you're going down the inflaton trajectory, you have all of these choices about what you can do in the transverse directions that actually are giving imprints at the still in the inflationary scale. So if you have, for example, a bifurcation and it goes to at least temporarily to a tachyonic mode. You'd have to be able to build all of that kind of structure.
Well, so I guess that what we have concentrated ourselves in this paper is situations in which these other degrees of freedom. I mean, for them to do anything, they have to be light, right? They have to have mass much smaller than Hubble. So there must be a reason why they are light, because if not, they don't fluctuate. So there must be a symmetry, something that protects them from getting very heavy, and so they must. And we took the example in which there was either a shift symmetry or there were the Gaussian bosons or some other symmetry or something like that. That's why they were light. So to the extent that there's a symmetry like this, those effects that you're talking about are very small and they only accumulate significantly outside the horizon. And so the thing what I told you is true.
I'm thinking probably the simplest example you can imagine, which is the hybrid inflation waterfalls in the transverse direction.
So right, so this is a very big breaking of the shift symmetry of the transverse direction, but it happens at the end, right? So as long as it happens at the end, it doesn't matter. If you want to have something which this happens, there's a breaking of the shift symmetry during inflation, then our thing will not work.
Okay, cool.
Okay, I think we should go to the session here, so let's thank Matthias.